Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. Frank, where are you calling in from this week?
I am on holiday or on vacation in Stockholm at the moment, David.
Okay. And that sounds exciting and relaxing.
It is very exciting and relaxing. My wife, as I think I've mentioned before, is Swedish, so we come here pretty regularly. And it's great. In fact, we just celebrated my daughter's birthday. My daughter, who's currently, she's studying in Stockholm, but has an internship in London at the moment. But she came through for the weekend, and we just celebrated her birthday with her and some of her friends.
And you are fluent in Swedish.
Fluent would be an exaggeration. I'm proficient in Swedish. I'm pretty. My comprehension's pretty fluent. My spoken Swedish is. Let's call it proficient.
Now, we have some Swedish listeners. Do you want to say anything to them now?
No, I don't. No. I'll just embarrass myself. But I'm
in a different way than we usually do. Okay, good.
I enjoy Sweden very much for lots and lots of reasons, personal and cultural. It's a place I have a great deal of affection to.
All right. Well, it's good you're getting some rest after Sheer.
Yes,
which must have been exhausting.
David, this week we should pick up on one of the things that arose from the Sheer conference. So, as our listeners will know, I hope, last week we were both at the Sheer conference, the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic, and I was the co-chair of the program committee for this year's Sheer conference in Boston, or Cambridge actually, with Sarah Pearsall from Cambridge University. And so I was involved in it. You attended your first year, but there was a kind of interesting kind of afterlife to Sheer that I thought we could talk about today, or we thought we could talk about today, which was the reason I'm kind of taking the lead is I want to interview you slightly because
okay.
You played a role in this controversy. Well, maybe it was a controversy. I don't know how you describe it. There was a bit of a kerfuffle.
A contentious conversation.
Yes, a full and frank exchange of views, as the Brits would say.
Say yes.
About the Constitution, and it started inadvertently with some tweeting that you were involved.
Well, I was.
Just give us the background, and then I'll ask you a question.
So the basic gist of it is that I was live tweeting a few of the panels, including a panel about the sort of relevance of the early republic to today. And one of the panelists, Serena Zabin, who I think is in Carleton University,
it's a college, I think it is.
Yes, was talking about the relevance of the Constitution today and the ways in which the Constitution is an 18th century document. And I tweeted something. I tweeted at Serena Zabin, has the Constitution outlived its usefulness? Hashtag Sheer19. And this generated far more response than I had anticipated, because most tweets sort of go out to the void, where some people, including people who were in the room when this panel was going on, responded by thinking that the mere idea that the Constitution has outlived its usefulness was outrageous. In some ways profane, unpatriotic, what have you. And other people coming to the conclusion, well, that's a perfectly reasonable and obvious question to ask.
Before we get to that question, David, can I ask you about how this, because not all of our listeners are academics. So can
yes.
you say something about live tweeting at conferences? And like, is this something you do? What is it? Do you do it regularly?
I do it irregularly. There are some people who do it much more frequently than I do, and probably better than I do. Like Liz Covart, our friend, Ben Franklin's world. She often live tweets conference panels. And it's tricky to do well. I think the line that I tweeted was verbatim what she said, but it's hard to sort of get the gist of somebody's argument into the confines of a tweet, especially while the thing's going on. It's not something I do extensively, but it's something that lots of people do in order to make in some ways to expand the size of the room for a panel, because only so many people can come to the conference. but lots of people want to go or want to be able to participate, you know, indirectly through, you know, Twitter or other mediums.
Do you think it's a good idea? Because there's in part we need to get to the actual content of this discussion that you inadvertently prompted, but one of the subtext, in fact, it was one of the themes, I think, it would be a proper way to put it, of that discussion, was some people saying, well, not quite attacking live tweeting, but saying, you know, Twitter isn't the right medium to have these discussions, because if you weren't in the room, you're losing out on the nuance and things like that. So there are, I mean, it's a more general criticism that could be made of Twitter, but I think particularly when relaying what academics are saying in a room and within an academic discussion.
Yeah.
You know, if for example, if somebody live tweeted some of our discussions on this podcast, the meaning of what we're saying could be misconstrued by people who are simply reading a tweet based on something we've said, as opposed to listening to the episode, right?
Oh, to be sure. You know, Twitter as a medium is deeply imperfect in terms of conveying meaning and subtlety and you know, audience and voice and all these things. You know, one of the things I noticed that they did at Sheer, and I've seen other conferences do this, they had in the front of the panelists, they had a trifold card that said, on one side of it said, you know, please tweet this panel, and had the Sheer hashtag with it. And the other side said, please do not live tweet this panel. You know,
so, I noticed that when I was sharing as well. Yeah. So presumably what was... now, I'm about to confess. I'm going to make a major confession here. I was one of the program co-chairs. I wasn't party to the creation of those signs, so I don't know at whose discretion was it that would the decision be made to either put the sign up saying, please tweet this panel, or don't tweet the panel?
I believe it's the panelist's discretion.
And
there was one or two times in the conference where people did switch it and actually pointed out and said, I don't want people to live tweet this for whatever reason. Which is, you know, a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but I think it's, you know,
you could do it for any reason or no reason.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I think the idea, you know, these conferences are extraordinarily expensive, and sometimes very difficult to get to, both in terms of the cost and in terms of the logistics, as you know, because you had some difficulty getting there.
And getting away, but that's another story.
But, you know, and the extent to which, you know, if you can, you know, I think part of the subtext of this particular conference was how important it was for academics to talk to a broader audience. And, you know, Twitter is one way of doing that. And obviously it's an imperfect way, but, you know, all modes of communication are imperfect, so. So I mean, it was an interesting conversation because part of it was a conversation about with people who were in the room, and part of it were people who were not in the room, and some of them were academics and some of them weren't. So I think that's actually a sign that Twitter's doing a good thing in terms of having a democratic vehicle for communication.
Okay, so sum up the conversation, if you would, for our listeners who don't necessarily follow you on Twitter.
Oh, they should, but
of course, or
not. I mean, I don't care. So the gist of it, in some ways, was there were half of the people who were saying, like, look, the Constitution is the document that creates the United States as a political entity. It is a living document that is amendable. So if there are problems with it, we can fix the problems, but we should stick with this foundational text, which has helped to create this political organization of which we are citizens. And, you know, the other half of the conversation was that the Constitution is a antiquated 200-year-old text that doesn't fit the needs of the 21st century, and it's not an outrageous question to pose whether it's an outdated document or not. And this conversation, I think, was interesting because basically, as soon as I got back from Sheer, I was listening to a Slate podcast, Amicus, with Dahlia Lithwick, which if you don't listen to it, you should. It's really, really, really good. But the person they were having on was a law professor, Mary Ann Franks, who is a book that either just came out or is just about to come out called The Cult of the Constitution, where she was making, exploring basically the same question about whether the Constitution, this document drafted in 1787, is really fit for purpose, you know, more than 200 years later, and whether, you know, the ways in which Americans talk about the Constitution really impedes meaningful political action and sort of a real representative democracy. You know, and she has some interesting ideas about sort of what to do about it. But, you know, I think there's a moment where we're looking at our political system right now and what's going on in Washington and what's going on in American politics more broadly. And, you know, part of the problem I think we've got today is we've got some particular politicians, which you either love or hate, depending on your, you know, ideology and worldview. But I also think we've got sort of structural issues with the way the government is structured that is making effective politics almost impossible. So I think we're in an interesting, I think that, you know, there's a ways in which these conversations are coming up simultaneously for a reason.
Right. Okay. So the question posed that Serena posed, and we need to credit her.
Yes.
And that you tweeted about was, is the Constitution fit for purpose?
Yeah. Has it outlived its usefulness? I think is the, right. The yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get the framing right. Has it outlived its usefulness? My own view would be, I think this is a complicated question, and I think, unsurprisingly, a room full of historians would argue about this. But it seems to me the case in favor of the Constitution is as follows. I think it's both practical and, I think, ideological as well. But on a practical level, I think one of the most important things to bear in mind is it's what we've got, given the current problems in the political system and in the culture at large, and, you know, which to some extent is one of the themes of this podcast, I'm not sure we could come up with something better or something workable at a practical level. I mean, you know, I think if we tried to hold a new constitutional convention today and come up with a new document, and, you know, my boy Jefferson suggested doing this every 19 years, which is one of his craziest ideas, I don't think we could come up with something, or the result might actually be, and I don't want to be hyperbolic about this, civil war, true constitutional failure. So that being said, whether the Constitution's fit for purpose or not, it's what we've got, it's what we're stuck with. Having said that, on a kind of intellectual and ideological basis, I think, you know, the framers of the Constitution did not believe that what they were laying down was sacred, you know, writ to apply for all time. They believed that they were creating a system that was meant to enshrine certain principles, and we get those in the Bill of Rights and in other parts of the Constitution. But there's an amendment process in the Constitution. They themselves recognized that the Constitution was created by men, and I'm using that word deliberately, of their time, but that times would change and that the Constitution, the document, should be flexible enough to change with it, which is why we have amendments to the Constitution. And Jefferson was not one of the framers of the Constitution, but he wasn't wrong in his impulse that we should have a new Constitution every 19 years, which is what he worked out a generation as, is completely impractical. But again, it reflects a view common at the time, particularly among people who've given a lot of thought to these issues, that circumstances change. As Jefferson famously said, the world belongs to the living. So, you know, the dead hand of the past shouldn't control future generations. And so I think that the intellectually, I think the founders or the framers, as they're often called, had a more sophisticated understanding of human nature than perhaps we credit them for, and recognized that times change and law and government and the Constitution would need to change with it. So if the Constitution's not necessarily fit for purpose, to answer Serena's question, it might be because of our failings politically rather than failings of the document. What do you think?
Well, so picking up on this you know, comment that Jefferson had about, you know, we should replace the Constitution every 19 years, there was an interesting study at the University of Chicago about a decade ago where they analyzed the lifespans of written constitutions. Anyone, you want to guess what the average, how long an average constitution lasts? And they started in 1789. That was their beginning point. So the U.S. Constitution is the starting point they went from. So things written since then, how long do constitutions last?
So were they only going with national constitutions, not state?
They're just doing national constitutions.
And provincial constitutions. Okay.
National constitutions.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with Jefferson's 19 years. I wonder if you're asking me a trick question. So I'll say 19, but I don't know what the hell I'm talking
about. It's close to that, 17 years.
Right. Okay. Well,
you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, I mean, some of those people are writing new constitutions because the first one they wrote, you know, didn't work, or because there was
a
war.
In the United States.
Right. Like there's lots of reasons why you'd write a new constitution, but sometimes countries write new constitutions simply because they think it's good to, you know, reevaluate old, you know, political powers and structures. And, you know, we've learned a lot about how constitutions should be written and the ways in which political power should be divided since 1787. And, you know, there's large parts of the U.S. Constitution that I think simply just don't work very well. I mean, it strikes me that the U.S. Constitution is like a Model T Ford. You know, it looks really nice, you know, at the you know, antique car show, because it's the first one. And maybe we've added seat belts to it since then and an 8-track player. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's actually fit for purpose. You wouldn't use that for your, you know, driving to work every day, because it can't go on the highway, and if you crash in it, you're going to die. You know,
right,
and
right. Yeah, but I want to push back just slightly, David. I mean, I think we're in broad agreement on this question, but let me come back at you a little bit on this, which is, you know, you mentioned the division of power. We know more about the division of power. I'm not so sure we do, in light of the past 240 years. I mean, I think the principles at the heart of the U.S. Constitution, which are derived largely from the British Constitution, but also from a lot of the intellectual heritage of the Renaissance. You know, the concept of the separation of powers, you know, the separation of powers within the Constitution is not the problem. I think there are other problems in the Constitution, how it's been allowed to evolve and operate, or the fact that the different branches of the government in some cases and at different times have abdicated their responsibilities. Again, I don't think that's a flaw of the Constitution so much as a flaw of the people who are holding office under its terms.
Well, I mean, if you think about Madison and the, you know, months leading up to the Constitutional Convention, he spent those months studying other constitutions.
Right.
And when countries go and write new constitutions now, they often hire people who have done this, who have looked and said, like, okay, what in the past 200 years have worked and what hasn't worked? You know, and for a while there was a point at which countries were copying the U.S. Constitution as a model of something that worked, and increasingly they're not. They're copying other models of how to distribute power and how to, you know, function that are not based on the American model. The American model is deeply out of style in terms of, you know, professional constitution writers, which is actually a cool job to think of it, but you know, there are large parts of it that just either, you know, if you think about what the Constitution lays out as its purpose, you know, in the preamble of, you know, ensure domestic tranquility, establish justice, I know I'm doing this in the wrong order, provide for the common defense and general welfare and blessings of liberty, etc., you know, how well is the government doing those things? The government is running, you know, it's but in terms of actually creating a representative government, there are things that the government simply can't do because of the ways in which the Constitution hamstrings it.
So, David, I don't think the separation of powers is the problem with the Constitution. I think the biggest single problem with the Constitution presently is the Senate and the way the Senate operates, more properly the way senators are allocated. So I think the fact that there are two senators for every state, which was meant to guarantee a level of equality between and among the states when the Constitution was adopted, is a huge obstacle now, because we have some states with huge populations and some states with very, very small populations. And that the kind of imbalance between the two is far greater than it was in 1789.
Yeah, I did some quick math here today on that particular question.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. So in 1790, according to the first census, Virginia was 12 times bigger than Delaware. And today, California is about 70 times bigger than Wyoming.
Right. Okay. Perfect.
And so it's orders of magnitude. Yeah, a lot bigger than.
Right. So if you're voting for a senator in Wyoming, you have far more influence, and you have more representation in Washington than a Californian does. And that seems to me to be inherently flawed. And this isn't just a left-right thing. I mean, at the moment, that system, the system tends to benefit Republicans, because the states with smaller populations are tending to vote Republican. But, you know, that's not universally true. I mean, you can take Vermont, for example, which is a very small state that is reliably Democratic. But it seems to me that's the biggest obstacle that we need to try and solve. You and I have discussed this in the past. I like the number 50. I like having 50 states, but I think you could redraw boundaries a little bit. I mean, we're constantly talking about gerrymandering and redrawing congressional boundaries and congressional districts, and the Supreme Court is considering whether that's legal or not. Well, why can't we do it for the Senate?
Well, or we could just get rid of the Senate entirely, because it's a deeply undemocratic institution.
Sure, but the problem with getting rid of the Senate is that would require a wholesale constitutional change.
Yes.
And we're back to my original statement, but I'm not sure our political system can handle that.
Well, I mean, I think in terms of solutions, I think you're right. But there are parts of the Constitution, and I think the Senate is I think you're right, the Senate's the big problem. The Electoral College, which has the same problem as the Senate, has never worked. Right? Like, the thing has never worked the way it was supposed to.
Well, in what way? Elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, in as much as I guess the original idea was you get, you know, representatives from various states together, and they actually decide in the Electoral College who they're going to vote for, right? You know, several of the amendments to the Constitution are about the Electoral College, because they're trying to sort of get this thing to work in a way that it's, you know, it's never really done.
So it's supposed to be like the College of Cardinals.
Cardinals, right? Yes, exact. That's... In some ways, yeah, I think that was the original idea, and it's never, ever been that. Maybe for, you know, two elections, and they picked George Washington both times, because that was the obvious choice, right? It effectively disenfranchises large numbers of people, because they're in, you know, reliably blue or red states.
In the same way the Senate does, yeah.
In the same way that the Senate does, right? Well, even in some ways more than the Senate does. And, you know, we've had several examples in recent, you know, history of the person who has the most votes not winning the office. You know, and so there's weird ways in which the Electoral College shapes the ways in which people campaign for office. And, you know, and so you don't end up with the person leading the country who most people want to lead the country. It's a stupid system that nobody else has copied, because it doesn't work very well. It leads to all kinds of, you know, really powerful distortions in the ways in which political power is distributed, that makes very little logical sense.
David.
Yes.
You are presently sitting in a country where the elected leader, the new Prime Minister Boris Johnson, was chosen by, I think it was 100,000.
Like 1%, yeah.
Less than 1%, 160,000 voters, of whom I think 92,000 voted for him. You know, so.
Well, I'm not endorsing that as the alternative either.
No, I understand that. But what I'm trying to suggest is there are sort of anomalies in every political system. I mean, I'm sitting in Sweden, where for a long time they haven't been able to form the government. Parliament for a long time was unable to form a government because it was seeking to keep out a party that was pretty explicitly anti-immigrant and racist. And as a result of that, none of the other major parties would enter into government with them. But that meant that it was impossible to form a government. I guess the point I'm making is, while there are flaws in the Electoral College, I think if we take a kind of global view on these things, all governmental systems are imperfect.
Okay. To be sure, right? Like, yeah, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government. So,
let me speak up for the Electoral College in only one way, and I have I'm kind of crossing my fingers right now as I say this. If the Electoral College has an advantage, it's that in close elections, I am not. I think there's a real problem when somebody loses the popular vote and wins in the Electoral College. But in a close election where somebody gets a majority in the popular vote, a slight majority in the popular vote, the Electoral College often amplifies their victory, which I actually think gives them more of a governing mandate.
Okay.
Can be useful. I mean,
it doesn't.
Ex post facto, I'm looking for benefits of the Electoral College. Electoral
College,
that
right.
is one when it happens. And historically, that's happened more often than the counter, which is, somebody losing the popular vote and winning in the Electoral College. What worries me in our current fractured system is we've now had two elections where somebody has lost the popular vote and won in the Electoral College in the past in 16 years, and that seems to me to be a worrying trend, and it could well happen in 2020. So I'm not here to kind of defend the Electoral College outright. I'm giving it one cheer, not three cheers, but I think it may not be as wholly flawed as you're suggesting. We need a system.
Yeah, but it's called a popular vote, which is an easy, much easier, simple system, a more logical system. Okay, so those things are broken. And the House right now isn't doing all that well either, given that the Supreme Court has basically given its okay to gerrymandering in quite profound ways, in which the party that wins the most votes in the state often has fewer representatives in the House because of the ways in which districts are gerrymandered, using modern technology that is, scary, the level of precision to which they can, chop and slice and clump together voters to come up with the outcomes that you want. We have situations now where 60% of the voters vote for one party and they get 40% of the representations in the House, and that doesn't make much sense. So the House isn't really working particularly well either in terms of representing the will of the people, and as much as that's what government ought to do. But on a sort of bigger point, I mean, people always say, well, the Constitution's amendable, and the amendment process, while it has been used 27 times, has not been actually used very much. If we think about the 27 amendments, 10 of them are the Bill of Rights, so those were passed right when the thing was written. And the 27th Amendment was actually originally one of the 12 passed by Congress in, 1789. So that leaves 16. Of the 16, none of them fundamentally change the way that the power is distributed within the government, other than maybe the direct election of senators. They've reformed the Electoral College a couple of times. They've done the 11th Amendment, which we've gone over before, that you dislike. They've expanded voting rights on several occasions, and those are wonderful milestones in terms of civil rights and the expansion of what democracy means. But in terms of the core structures of how the government works, we haven't, the amendment process hasn't allowed any of those things to change in meaningful ways.
But it has, yes. However, the amendment process also fundamentally redefined the relationship of citizens in the state and who is a citizen.
Oh, yeah, to be sure.
Especially in your period. And given that power in a republican system is derived from the people and sovereignty originates with the people, that's a pretty big.
Yeah, I don't know, to be sure, right? But the Constitution tends to get reformed in clumps, right? If we look at all the amendments, they tend to sort of clump together. We've got, the 13th, 14th, and 15th after the Civil War. Okay, so we are able to amend the Constitution after 750,000 people die. In some ways, that's the consequence of that war. Those amendments wouldn't have happened without it. You've got amendments that happen during the Progressive Era with, you know, direct election of senators, the income tax, women's suffrage, what have you. And then you've got the 10/11 that were passed immediately after the Constitution was ratified. But otherwise, it's a, you know, under normal political circumstances, it's very, very hard, nay, impossible to amend the Constitution in a meaningful way.
Right, but let's pause there for a second, because one of the things we began with, or you raised this issue about how long between constitutions, or how long do states go before they create, how long does the average constitution last? Sorry. And I think we in the United States kind of adhere to this fiction across the political spectrum. Indeed, it was the premise of that discussion at Scheer, that the Constitution, we have this unbroken constitutional tradition going back to 1789 or 1787, whenever you want to date it. I don't think that's true. I think if we were French about this and we kind of counted the number of republics we have, I think those very constitutional moments you've talked about create a new constitutional settlement. We adhere to the fiction that we have one constitution going back to 1789, but we basically get a new constitutional settlement during Reconstruction with those Reconstruction amendments.
So oh, yeah, the first, that's to be sure.
If the first republic lasts from 1789 until 1877 or 1861, however you want to debate it, that's fine. The second republic maybe goes from 1877 to the Progressive Era. The third republic is from the Progressive Era down to, I think, those the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights legislation of the mid-1960s is another crucial turning point. So we have had moments of profound constitutional change. What we haven't done, and in those moments, the Constitution has evolved significantly. And that's constitutional change, which, again,
no, to be sure,
I might push back on the very premise of the question we began with and the premise that Serena raised at the conference, because the Constitution, maybe we're due for another of those, because we haven't had a profound moment of constitutional change since the mid-1960s. And that's what we're really looking for, rather than replacing it.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, if our these precedents are our guide for this, these kinds of profound changes in the, you know, either big C or little C constitution, are times of pretty extreme national crises, or social revolution of a kind.
That's what we're in the midst of right now, anyway.
Yeah.
Follow what it is.
Which is true, and both true and scary. Because I mean, right now I'm thinking about sort of just the, you know, things. I'm thinking about the gun violence after the shooting in California yesterday, a couple days ago. You know, we've now had more than 20 years of pretty extreme mass shootings in the United States, and no vehicle meaningfully for politically for remedying these, in part because of the structures of power, the way the Senate is structured, the way that, you know, that power gets distributed in the House and in the White House and the courts, and because of a badly worded Second Amendment from 1789 that people are debating exactly what was in James Madison's head when he wrote it. Making the kind of common sense legislation to outlaw assault rifles, which has happened in every other civilized country in the world, sort of a political non-starter in the United States. The fact that the reason why the United States hasn't passed gun legislation has to do with these problems that were created 200 years ago.
No. I disagree with that. I certainly agree with you on the gravity of the problem. But I think that's a justification that people in the NRA and the gun rights movement have kind of fastened on. And indeed, the history of the NRA suggests this is a relatively recent
development. Oh, to be sure. Oh, yeah, no, you're right. That isn't a new interpretation.
And it is a problem, but it's not. It's if the political will were there, they could do something about that. And the Second Amendment does not prevent that.
But the political will is there, though. I mean, I think that something like, a huge percentage of Americans want assault rifles banned. You know, the polling for the past 20 years has said this.
Right, and the Second Amendment doesn't prevent that.
Well, no, but the Supreme Court has said that the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to own guns.
Right, but it also, I mean, we've talked about this already, but it says well-regulated. I mean, Congress and states could adopt the legislation to ban assault weapons. The Constitution does not prohibit that.
But right now in the Senate, 30% of the country could stop 70% of the country from doing that.
Sure, and we're back to the thing we do agree on, that the problem here is the Senate.
Okay, so we get rid of the Senate. Okay, good. I'm glad we're agreeing on this.
Get rid of really small states.
States. Which of those is easier?
Well, I mean, Nate Silver suggested something recently, and I basically agree with him. You combine the Dakotas, you add Delaware to Pennsylvania. I can't remember the rest of the details of his suggestion, but you could break California into add D.C. as a state, give D.C. statehood. Puerto Rico should become a state. I mean, there are, and if you did that,
okay.
Senate, I agree with you that perhaps the Senate isn't the best institution, and getting rid of it would be a great idea. We're not going to get rid of the Senate for the very reasons I told suggested.
Oh yeah, no, I think the question of is the system working well and can we fix it are two separate questions.
Right.
And I think, and this was actually the sort of conclusion that Marianne Franks reached when she was on Amicus, like the system is maybe not broken, but clearly not functioning particularly well. But our options for fixing it aren't great ones. Because we could, to be sure, have another constitutional convention, but I think, as you point out, given the nature of our politics today, unless we pick people that no one's ever heard of to lead this convention, who somehow are able to bridge political divides that our current class of political leadership can't, that's not going to turn out well.
Right. Again, the other cautionary note I would strike, though, is if you take a global view and you look at the other so-called liberal democracies. It's not, the picture's not great at the moment, and I'm not sure that's because of constitutional reasons in any of them, so much as it is that we are facing some sort of crisis, whether these populist responses to demographic and climate change or what have you. It's a profoundly disturbing moment, and certainly the U.S. Constitution has its limitations. I'm not, I think you and I are in agreement on that, but I'm not so sure. I think the problems that beset us are political and social, because if you see it in other systems where they have different constitutions, they have similar problems.
That's true. That's a very good point. One of the things that has come up both in the Twitter thread and in the discussion on Amicus was, there is a way in which Americans relate to their Constitution that seems to be different from the ways in which people of other countries relate to their constitutions. In as much as Americans revere their Constitution as a kind of sacred text, much more so than most other countries. Which partially explains, but it's longevity and its antiquity. It does have it has 18th century language embedded in it, so it sounds smart in the way that 18th century documents tend to sound smart, even if you translate them into plain language, they're not saying anything particularly intelligent. And that's, I think, an interesting facet about American politics.
Yes, I agree. American political culture, it invokes the authority of the Constitution to defend their position, and invokes the authority of the founders you know, wants to get right with the founders, so-called. As somebody who works on the founders, I think this is stupid and absurd, but it's a reality in American political culture. There's no doubt about that, and you don't necessarily see that to the same extent in other liberal democracies. I agree with you about that, and so that is a unique feature of it, and it's an obstacle to change. If you believe this is almost sacred writ, and, you know, the language isn't a million miles from the King James Bible in parts of it, you know, therefore it can't be changed. You know, there's the belief takes root that it can't be changed.
And yeah, people get tattoos with parts of the Constitution on them. I don't see people in other countries getting similarly inscribed on their flesh. The National Archives, the building where it's housed, looks like a temple. And people process in front of the Constitution like it's a, you know, sacred relic or something, rather than a piece of...
I think that's an obstacle to change.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem. We have a paradox here where its apparent success, its very longevity, although, as you know, I've just questioned that, is an obstacle to trying to do something about it. Because it's always been that way, and it must be good because it's old, and so on. I mean, we have a paradox. We think of the United States as a young country, and in global historical terms, it is. But it's actually got one of the older governmental systems that one sees anywhere in the world.
This whole conversation, though, has led me, you know, to be very sort of dispirited about the possibilities for meaningful political change, right? Because I see so many ways in which the system and the structures of power and the way in which power is distributed within the government and within the broader polity, make creating domestic tranquility and, you know, all these other kinds of things that we say the Constitution is supposed to do, actually achieving those things possible without, you know, either some meaningful change to the text or a certain kind of, reformulation the way that you posited, you know, like during Reconstruction or like during the Progressive Era. Sort of seeing the future in that is a bit cloudy for me.
Well, I'd say two things. And one is, if this podcast has demonstrated anything, it's we're terrible at predicting the future.
Yes. No. God, yeah.
The second is, you tend to be slightly more pessimistic than me, even though you're young and have so much more to live for.
I'm pessimistic about politics. I'm optimistic about most things.
I'm a little more optimistic. I think, you know, just get out and vote. The Constitution still lets you do that. It's imperfect. The system's imperfect, and you got to fight for it.
Oh,
and,
to be sure. No, I'm 100% for that. Yeah.
You know, change is possible. Change is possible. We've seen it historically. We see it globally. You know, people in Hong Kong are protesting right now. People in Russia are protesting right now. The flaws of the just, you know, as the saying goes, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. The Constitution is not perfect. The framers of the Constitution knew that. They would in some ways be bemused, I think, by what's going on today. On another level, I don't care what they would have thought about today, because they don't, you know, they don't matter. But, you know.
Frank says founders don't matter. Okay, that's the way that gets live tweeted, and people think of it.
And that's why you can't live tweet this. But, you know, we've got to We can't be hamstrung by the past either. I mean, Jefferson did understand that when he said, you know, you can't, you know, the dead hand of the past can't control the present. So it's up to us to make the present that we need and respond and find solutions to the problems that confront us. I'm not sure spending our energy reforming the, and I know you're not suggesting this, reforming the Constitution is the way to do that, because I think we'll just have a big fight and gain very little as a result of that. So we need to fight within the system we've got and improve that system where we can, overthrow those aspects of the system that don't work. And historically, as we talked about already today, in the 1860s and 70s that happened, in the 1910s and well, in the 1910s it happened, and in the 1960s it happened. We're about due for another one. Hope,
okay.
David, hope. Change. All right, well, it's right around the corner. You just can't see it yet.
All right. On that.
I'm in Sweden, I'm happy.
All right.
Place where it's a kinder, gentler nation.
Jeez. All right. So when the second civil war breaks out, then we'll be able to reform the Constitution. Anyway.
The second civil war breaks out, I can go to Sweden.
Exactly. And I'll be in Edinburgh. So it'll be fine. Right. Last drops. What you got?
Well, I have two, David. One is a happy anniversary. This is our 99th episode. Do you want me to send 99 red balloons to you?
No, I'm good, thanks.
So yes, our next episode will be our 100th. So we'll be 100 not out, to use a cricket phrase. That's our sanctuary. That's great. So I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for all your efforts over this past couple of years. And thank you
to listeners for listening for 99 episodes.
Yep, thank you to listeners, of course, our loyal fans, and hope we haven't wasted your time. But I also wanted to endorse, there was an essay last week that appeared in the New York Times by David Blight, who's a Yale historian, who will be known to many of you, and David Blight recently wrote a kind of blockbuster biography, an award-winning biography of Frederick Douglass, but Blight took on this notion that the Republicans are the party of Lincoln, and he demonstrated in no uncertain terms that the party of Trump is not the party of Lincoln. So I commend that to you, because it's a very popular expression among Republicans, especially from Dinesh D'Souza, among others. Democrats are responsible for racism in the United States historically, and we're the party of slaveholding, which is true. But the parties have changed labels or have changed their clothing over the past century and a half, and Blight makes that case for quite in a very strong way. But he's just a wonderful writer, so it's an essay that's worth your attention. What about you, David? What's your last?
Before I went to Shear last week, I was in Philadelphia for a few days and was able to visit the Constitution Center, which I'd never been to before. And so I want to recommend the Constitution Center, but in particular, they've got an exhibit on right now on Reconstruction that looks at the ways in which, you know, the events on the ground and the amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th, you know, sort of interacted with each other. And it's a really very well done exhibit that sort of, you know, doesn't focus too much on events on the ground, doesn't focus too much on the amendments, tries to look at the ways in which those things interact. So I want to highly recommend the Constitution Center and their current exhibit on Reconstruction for those people who can make it to Philadelphia.
Excellent.
Great. Until next week, until our 100th episode,
okay,
cheers.
Okay, David. Yep, cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.